Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
This is the year of lost opportunities. Looking at what has happened in North America, looking at what has happened in Europe, instead of changing, of looking for a better, a more sustainable economy, one that destroys nature less, one is that is less unjust, we see how the elites are protecting that system, and they're sacrificing human rights and democracy itself.
That's the voice of Maria Paez, a Venezuelan sociologist living in Toronto. On this week's show, we speak to Maria about the similarities between the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela and the Idle No More movement in Canada. Stay tuned.
Dr. Maria Paez Victor is a sociologist. She's a Canadian-Venezuelan sociologist, and we're very privileged to have her on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sylvia. I'm very pleased to be speaking with you and all the listeners in the radio.
Thank you. Now, when I think about the current movement that we are seeing spark in Canada, the Idle No More movement, I think of the social implications of this relationship that we are trying to create. And I was reminded of the Caracaso in Venezuela, another revolution that started with a peaceful movement. Can you talk a little bit about the Caracaso, perhaps, and then perhaps, if you see connections, talk about how the Idle No More can spark the same kind of enthusiasm, energy, and possibilities into a transformative movement in Canada?
This is very interesting because the Caracaso started with a betrayal, an absolute cynical betrayal by the government. The governments are very important, really. It is that which reflects the nation, you know. And when people no longer believe in the institutions that form its government, I don't just mean the prime minister or president or whatever, but its proper institutions, then you have a very serious problem in your country. In Venezuela, the president was Carlos Andrés Pérez, who was just elected. We're talking about the Caracaso happened in 1989, in February, the 27th. And that president had been elected, and his campaign was a campaign absolutely against neoliberal policies. And he denounced the International Monetary Fund. He said they would not open the market. They would not be privatized. And of course, when he got to power, that's exactly what he did. You had President Carlos Andrés Pérez and the Minister of Finance, Moisés Naím, who now goes around the world attacking Venezuela. These two men were responsible for the biggest genocide that has happened in Venezuela since the time of the Spaniards. They both, immediately when they got to power, accepted the conditions of the International Monetary Fund and started to apply what they called el paquete, which means the package of neoliberal austerity policies. He started to privatize all state companies. He reduced the import taxes for products, manufacturing products, which absolutely destroyed small and medium companies. Companies that made food, companies that made clothes, all of these were overnight because they were allowing the big corporations to import to Venezuela without even paying import. But on the night of February 26, they passed these laws. And the next day, when the people woke up and went to catch a bus to go into work very early in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, they found that their bus ticket cost 300% more than than normal. And the bread was 200% more because the government had stopped subsidies for gasoline. This created a riot in a small town called Guarenas, which is right next to Caracas. And it spread like wildfire to the capital, Caracas. Now, nobody, absolutely nobody, directed this riot. This was a true popular uprising, and the people just took to the streets. The response of the government was to get out not just the police, but the army. And what they did was they went around indiscriminately killing people in the low-income areas, which are called barrios. An eyewitness, very close friend of mine, she saw the army standing like a firing squad on the pavement and indiscriminately firing up and down these little hills, just up and down. And the shacks are sort of very, you know, very fragile. And it would kill anybody in that path, whether they were inside a house or not. In one day, there were 3,000 dead on the streets of Caracas. Now, Carlos Andrés Pérez, after that, was in fact indicted, and he was turned off his position as president because they got evidence of corruption, of him having stolen from the treasure of the country, and a new president came in. But, very interesting, while he was still president, this Caracaso, this terrible thing that happened, was what spurred in 1992 the young Hugo Chavez to try and topple the government, the coup d'etat. Now, it's interesting because at the time, and I remember this distinctly, the main intellectuals of Venezuela supported that coup. They said, well, you know, it isn't right, you know, to take up arms, but these were not adventurers, they would say. This attempted coup in 1992 is because of the direct corruption and mismanagement and you know, brutality of the government. Chavez was jailed. I think he was jailed for less than 2 years because then the next president, which was Rafael Caldera, pardoned him, and he was allowed to go free. And well, we know what happened. He created his movement, and he is now president of Venezuela. And Carlos Andrés Pérez remained in, because he was 70 years old, he remained in prison in his own home, and then afterwards was allowed to leave the country. Now, what happened here was a total betrayal of a government that showed corruption, that showed no mercy towards its people, that had said one thing and done the other. And, of course, I'm not saying that this is, you know, every country has its own political culture and its own ways of reacting. But what I see that is similar to the Idol No More, and thank goodness that there hasn't been any deaths and nobody has called out the army and killed anybody. On the contrary, the Idol No More barricade in Sarnia, the police there actually refused to obey a court injunction to take down the barricade because they were not going to go against these people. This is really quite wonderful. This is the political culture of Canada works out, which is not the same as in Venezuela. In Venezuela, they would have been gunshots everywhere. But what is similar is the betrayal. If we put ourselves in the position of the indigenous peoples of this country, we could see that there has been a betrayal against their treaty rights. There have been betrayal against the rights that have been recognized by the Canadian government. We see that Bill C-45 and the omnibus bill that destroyed the environmental policies that we had were a betrayal of something fundamental for the indigenous peoples, which are their treaty rights. It violates their sovereignty over their lands. What has happened? The government of Canada has said, we are using our power to open the traditional treaty lands of indigenous peoples, and we are saying that we are going to give the right to corporations to exploit those natural resources. And you're talking about oil, you're talking about chemical companies, you could even be talking about uranium. I mean, Sarnia is an area that has been destroyed by pollution. The oil refineries in and around Sarnia, the chemical plants along the St. Clair River, the horrible uranium tailings in that area up there. I mean, the air, the land has been polluted. And what these Bill C-45 does is allows development on areas that have been protected by treaty rights, you know, the rivers, the lands. It allows the exploitation of corporations there. It's a frontal attack, not only on the indigenous peoples, but on the environment of Canada, our land, our water, our air. And so Idle No More began with women. It was women who were carrying on a teaching about this Bill C-45. And I think it started in Saskatoon, and then they went to Regina and I think Prince Albert. And they were teaching, look, this is terrible. This is terrible what's happening. And they broadened it. So it wasn't just the indigenous peoples. They brought in other Canadians who immediately saw this is something against all of us. And we've seen dramatically how Chief Teresa Spence from the Attawapiskat began a hunger strike. And this hunger strike's gone on for 25 days. This woman could die. And she said, I will not stop unless Prime Minister Harper comes to speak to me. And you know, Harper doesn't speak to the premiers. He's refused to meet with the premiers of this country. He refuses to meet with the press. You remember how always prime ministers walk up Parliament, and as they walk up the steps or as they come down the stairs, there's always, you know, what they call a scrum. There's always a press there, and prime ministers say, oh, hello, hi, yes, I'm going to do this. There's always some little, you know, interchange with the. None of this happens with Harper. Absolutely nothing. Every time he meets with the press, it is extremely staged. There is no spontaneity there. He has refused to meet with the indigenous people. And, you know, the hilarious thing is that just yesterday he said he would meet with her. But he said it doesn't have to do with her, with a protest or with her hunger strike. Of course it does. You know, they lie. And what we have here is a situation where a government is in danger of not just breaking faith of a particular party, say the Conservative Party, but they are in danger of breaking faith of Canadians and Indigenous peoples with the very idea of Canada, with the institutions of Canada, with all that makes up the government, not just a party. This is serious stuff. Those environmental laws that have been ransacked by the Omnibus Bill and by Bill 45 are something that will touch every Canadian, and they may not be aware of it now. And I thank the Indigenous peoples who have been the first to sound the alarm on this. But we are going to be seeing that we are destroying the very nature, the very natural resources that we have in this country. And I hate calling them natural resources because natural resources involve selling and buying and whatever. But I'm talking about the enjoyment and just the being of nature that is there. We have a government right now that has given green light to rapacious corporations. Rapacious, not responsible ones, but rapacious corporations to dig for oil, to dig for mining, to create chemical plants, to continue with uranium tailings, mining of uranium. Indeed, it's a pro-nuclear government. That what you hear is how, there's a new technology of smaller nuclear plants. All of this is smoke and mirrors, of course. So I would say the the thing that separates a Caracaso from the idle No More and separates it from the Occupy Canada and Quebec student movement is the fact that, fortunately, it has not been as violent and as horrific as the Caracaso. But what unites them is a lack of belief, profound belief, in the leadership of the country. Now, there is one aspect which was very violent, and we saw this in Toronto before our very eyes, in this, I would say that Canada is a very pacific nation compared to many, and what we saw was the violent use of violence in this town during the G20 protest. We saw police acting like goons. We saw provocateurs. We saw that not one provocateur, these were the people dressed in black who were breaking windows and such, not one of those was arrested. This is why they were obviously provocateurs. But in one day, 2,000 protesters were arrested and put into, the only way to describe them are cages without water, without food, with anything for over 24 hours. And so there we saw even a government lie, because the government of Ontario lied, said that the police had certain powers to keep people away and not to allow them to protest and such. And it turns out that that was unconstitutional. There was no such power. So things can get pretty nasty in Canada, too.
I'm afraid we have slowly been walking that stretch of road. When you look at the omnibus bills, when you look at the immigration bills, when you look at the kind of legislations to prevent teachers from even striking, making constitutional rights of workers, now illegal actions, I think that perhaps the way in which that violence is revealed is different. You know, maybe
yes,
it's not at the
exactly.
at the sound of the gunshot.
There is a war. There is a war against workers in Canada. There is a war against unions in Canada. When you think of the law C-377, it obliges unions to reveal their financial structure, even though they don't receive any public money. And yet corporations who do receive public money and all kinds of subsidies, there is no such law that makes them make transparent their financial structure. We see governments in Canada, both federal and provincial, fighting against the unions of the public service, like teachers in Ontario, against hospital employees. And what is happening? And what has happened this year, Sylvia, is the main economic news isn't the financial cliff in the United States. It isn't even the economic disaster in Europe. The biggest thing that's happened this year is that we have seen the economic elites arm themselves and fight no matter what to preserve this capitalist system, and they are stepping on peoples, on nations, and entire nations, on human rights, labor rights, and democracy itself. Now, you know that the capitalist system, as those that study it, always say that it's cyclical, that you always have booms and busts, that you have these cycles. Well, this crisis that we have right now is different, because it is carried out in the backdrop of a planetary environmental and climate crisis and a political crisis that goes to the very values of modern civilization, which is the modern democracy. This is the year of lost opportunities. Looking at what has happened in North America, looking what has happened in Europe, instead of changing, of looking for a better, a more sustainable economy, one that destroys nature less, one is that is less unjust. We see how the elites are protecting that system, and they're sacrificing human rights and democracy itself, and not in some remote sort of place, you know, but in the very center of capitalism, which is the United States and Europe. This is the disaster that we are facing right now in Canada and elsewhere, that they are arming themselves to protect this, as President Chavez calls it, this barbarous sort of capitalism, this type of capitalism that we have today.
Speaking with economist Robin Hanel, he points out that the fiscal cliff, the so-called fiscal cliff, is one that has been made up as a way, in a way, as a distraction, right, for what needs to be, for what the people are calling. People have exposed the 99%, and the inequality between the 99%, which is all of us, and the 1%, that really their capital has no nationality. You know, Microsoft, you know, Amazon, all these great big corporations, plutonic power, they don't really care. They're not even required to pay taxes in several cases. And some of them don't even pay any taxes at all, as in the case of Amazon, unless they have some sort of place, right? So the question that concerns me is, when is it that we reach that critical point where people say no more? And I think the I Don't Know More movement is pointing to that the passing of Bill C-45, a law that opens up vast parts of Canada, you know, many of them lands that are protected by native sovereignty rights, they're being opened up for unadulterated exploitation, devastation, and, you know, literally desecration, right? When you think of the tar sands, the uranium mines that have plagued, you know, several parts of Canada for decades, and now here in Canada, the opening of shell beds and contamination of water, all of those things affect not just the animals, the nature, the ecosystems, but also all of us. You know, it compromises our lives. So what about our climate cliff? What about the climate cliff that we are all facing? And, you know, there is no life beyond this planet. We don't have, we need certain things to survive. So let's talk a little bit about the different possibilities that can be created when you have a responsive government that listens to the people, not the corporate interests. Can we talk a little bit about the changes that took place in Venezuela that acknowledge that the economy, yes, is important, is a component of culture, but there is something greater that needs to be addressed, and that is inequality?
The great success of the Bolivarian Revolution is based on really, I would say, two things, maybe three. The first one is political will. President Chavez and the people around him had the will, the very clear notions that they have to change the country, and that the country had to be a participatory democracy, and that they were going to stop the colonization of Venezuela, that the petroleum belonged to the people were starving, and they were going to use everything to give them what they needed. So you had a group that were very politically motivated and very clear as to what justice was. And the second pillar is that they realized they could not do this. This is a small group of people that supported President Chavez and knew clearly what had to be done. The ones who had to do it were the people. That's why the words participatory democracy and the structure that it meant was put into the Constitution that was written by the people. And so this is really important. We have always kowtowed in Canada and kowtowed in a terrible way to the elites in Canada. This is a very elitist society, and the elites have worked sometimes. Other times they haven't. Most of the time, elites just work for themselves. But especially when there's a lot to give out. But when there isn't, when the times are scarce, these elites are fierce and protect themselves. So you ask, when do we reach a critical point? Well, look, the Aboriginal peoples right now have reached a critical point. They have to defend their land. They are their land. Aboriginal peoples aren't peoples that are going to say, oh, we live here, we'll just move and go over to that other land over there and live there. They identify with their land, and that's what they're protecting. The students in Quebec said no more. The laws that the Liberal government in Quebec were passing meant that many of them would not be able to continue their studies, that many of them would never even get into the university with these absolutely revolting laws that were destroying the access to education. So there comes a point when people organize and people then protest. Now, if it's just a protest, it doesn't work. It's really hard to just go out with a poster and a scream, slogans or whatever. No, they must organize. They must organize and they must pressure. Look, Harper is going to go visit Chief Theresa Spencer, because they organized. So when you reach a critical point, people will organize, and I hope that they do so, because... And this is a problem that we have, there are many divisions amongst progressive people, and they have to learn what unity is. This is one of the great things that has happened in Venezuela. The government isn't just the political party of the governing party. They also have what they call the Polo Patriotico, which is they have united with the social movements. And so when elections come around, when there's a particular policy that they want to pass or whatever, they discuss it with the organized groups of non-governmental groups, the popular movement, and say, what do you think of this? Give us your input. Will you support this? And then the government has the support. They're not manipulating them. They're not telling them, do this, do that. But they have included them in their garden, sort of to say. The important thing that I'm talking about is the openness. If you have a government that is open to hear what the people want, what the neighborhoods want, what the different indigenous peoples need. It's that openness that is missing right now with the people who are running the Canadian government in Ottawa right now, and who are also running the different, not all of them, but many of the provincial governments, some more than others and some less than others. We need respect for the voice of people. The representative democracy isn't enough. It isn't enough that we have members of parliament, members of the legislature. We need a greater representation of the day-to-day things that are happening to people across the country.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
And thank you, Sylvia.
And best wishes to the Bolivarian people, and of course our best wishes to President Chavez for a full and fast recovery.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being with us. Take care. That was Dr. Maria Paez-Victor. She's a sociologist, Canadian Venezuelan sociologist. We reached her in Toronto.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.